Chapter 14. My White Angel. When I awakened to consciousness again, I was lying in the middle of a barren plain, and in the far horizon there was a faint light like the first streak of dawn in the night sky. Around me the ground presented the appearance of the crater of a volcano, whose fires have died out but whose cinders are yet warm with the fire that once kindled them into life. No living being was near me. I was absolutely alone, and as I arose, and shading my eyes with my hand, looked towards the dawning light, I became conscious that some strange change had passed over myself. My form was bent like that of an old man, I could not straighten myself up, and my hands, as I examined them, were shrunken and wrinkled as by extreme old age. I passed my hands over my head, and lo! I was as bald as an infant. My luxuriant black beard was gone, also my features felt sharp, and my cheeks like hollow caves. Startled and uneasy, I turned to look for some stream in which to behold myself, and saw near my feet a deep dark pool, whose black waters reflected like a mirror my face and form. Alas! Yes, it was even as I feared. All trace of youth had left me, my wasted, almost fleshless, form was that of an old man, my hollow eyes were dim and sunken, my hands feeble and shaking as though palsied, and my body bent and my steps slow and faltering. In my surprise and horror, I cried aloud to know the meaning of this change, and like a distant echo a woman's soft voice replied to me, "Oh, my son, you did live in your short life of earth and in the dark sphere through an amount of passion and experience, which comes to most men only with age. You did consume your youth with fierce desires, and your manhood with your hunger for revenge, and the flames of your passions have burnt up the youth of your soul and withered up the beauty of your spirit form, so that there is naught left but the dry husk of an old man's form. Yet, O my son, my beloved son, if upon the scorched plain, which the fierce fires of earth have devastated, there springs up anew a fresher, tenderer foliage, a finer, purer vegetation, shall not the wilderness of your soul blossom into fresh life, and the dry ashes of your dead past be hid by the fair flowers whose seeds you may yet sow even in the sad earth of this, the sphere of remorse and repentance? Your tears of sorrow shall water this dry soil. Your hands shall labor in its fields until yonder streak of palest dawn shall change to glorious day, and the bare land around shall blossom with the sweet roses of tenderness and love. I cannot come to you, my son, but you shall climb the rugged path, which leads to me, and in a fair land of golden hope, you and I shall enjoy the tender joys of the love you hast never known. Fare you well, yet think not that I leave you save only for a time. Fare you well." The sweet voice died away, and as it faded, I called and called to my white angel to show me but one glimpse of her dear form. Then upon the dark background of the sky, I saw a faint flickering reflection, so pale, so shadowy, it was like a figure traced in mist, yet I knew it to be my sweet mother's lovely form, and as with joy I saluted it, it faded gradually away, and I stood upon the dark plain once more alone. Wearily and sadly did I wander on and on through that barren land. No fair flowers gladdened my eyes, no green tree afforded me the sense of shelter. No fresh stream of living water sparkled forth to slake my thirst, no sweet fruits to stay my hunger. All was desolate, blossomless, fruitless, and lonely. At last I reached the foot of a low range of hills, and as after many a stumble and many a slip, I dragged my feeble limbs by rugged rock-strewn pathways to the top of them, I saw far below me on the further side a still Gracie, whose quiet waves lapped gently on the sandy shores with a faint murmur that was soothing to my weary heart. The gray streak of dawn was still before me on the horizon of that strange sea, and clouds of pale gray mist-like wandering shadows chased each other slowly across the darkened sky. As I sat resting upon the hilltop, faint pictures began to appear between me and the gray floating clouds, even as in the far-off days of my boyhood. The fair visions of my youth had done when I had lain upon some grassy hill and watched the evening sky dim. At first, the pictures grew gradually clearer, and I recognized that they showed to me the drama of my life. I saw not alone the events of my earth existence, but the subtle influences of the spirit world that were at work to mold each thought and shape each action. I saw my father and my mother as they met at first. He surrounded by all the influences of the ambitious conqueror, the angel of the blood red star and his cohort of fierce followers who had hovered around the battlefields of Earth, and shared in the excitement of each contest. Then I saw my mother, as one enveloped in a veil of silver gossamer, the pure spirits of the silver star surrounding her like a cloud of white angels, with outspread protecting wings. I saw her drawn within the influence of my father's surroundings, and shadowed by the dark wings of the destroying angel, while with bowed heads and drooping pinions the white angels seemed to hover sadly near her. I saw Queen Artemisia, and I read in her heart all the passionate sense of injustice, of slighted love, of wounded pride that raged like a tempest, and I beheld the dark angel as he bent and whispered in her ear. I saw my father, beset by his love and his anxiety, building the fatal secret passage, and cementing its secrecy with the blood of the poor slave he had caused to be murdered. I saw the exultant face of the dark spirit as he welcomed this miserable victim of the king's suspicious fears to his dominion, to use him as a tool to help on the drama with which he was amusing himself. I saw it progress step by step as the ill-concealed devotion to my mother fanned the flame of Artemisia's wrath to a yet fiercer glow. I saw my mother's death and my own birth, and noted that while her pure soul was borne away by the white angels to their sphere, the shadow of the dark angel's wings rested upon the child that was half hers and half Eljazid's son. I saw that as I grew to manhood, the restless desires, the selfishly ambitious hopes, the instinct to rule over my fellows and force them to give me the lion's share of everything, sprang up like giant weeds and twined around the delicate shoots of pure and holy thoughts, which the angels of the snow-white silver star had sown ere I was born, side by side with the seeds of evil sown by the dark angels. I saw the pure spirits striving through the medium of the good priest Abubutha, to turn my thoughts from earthly joys, and I saw that as men play a game of chess with the light and dark pieces to represent the forces they control, so did the light and dark angels strive for possession of my soul, each limited in every act and every move they made by the unalterable laws of the spirit world, in accordance with which all the universe is upheld. I saw the inducements of the one set of spirits presented to my mind, and then the counter-attractions of the other, and noted how the inherited tendencies of my nature inclined the balance to the one side or the other, and because I was the son of Eljazid the warrior, rather than the son of Cynthia the dreamy enthusiast, I saw the scale of my desires weigh down towards the dark angel and the gifts he held in his hand. Every little incident of my life was reproduced, and when I came to the scene wherein I had stood beneath the trees in the desert at the parting of the ways, I saw that the fair spirit of my mother had stood at the end of the shining path, and pointed out to me the palace of Pasaikkad, and the father who mourned ever for me as one dead and lost to him. But before I could see that tender mother's spirit, the dark angel had drawn his mantle between mine eyes and the fair vision, and had turned my thoughts to him and to the dark mysteries he offered to unveil. I beheld that the scales of good and evil weighed down and down on the side of darkness, till I sank down into a dark gulf. And for a time I could see no more but methed that the white angels bowed their heads and veiled their faces as though they wept for the soul that had sunk down, and I bowed mine own head and wept bitter tears of shame as I thought on the deep degradation of the life I had led with Jalal ad-Din, and the gross desires of my animal soul to which I had yielded, when I had followed the darkened pathway by his side. How long I mourned over my sins I know not, but when at last I uncovered my head and looked up, I saw that the pictures of my life were visible once more. I now observed figure of Mansur hovering around Jalal ad-Din and myself, inspiring our thoughts and controlling our actions, and at times taking possession of Jalal ad-Din's body and using it as though it was the mortal envelope of his own spirit. Thus he seemed to enjoy again and again all the sensual pleasures of the earth life, and this I knew to be his meaning when he had told me in the dark sphere that for the gratification of his base desires, he had dragged down the soul of Jalal ad-Din. Me I saw that he could not thus control. My body he could not enter, even when he had withdrawn the spirit from it. But as again and again I yielded to the temptation to degrade myself, I saw with a shudder that the barrier that kept him back from my body grew thinner and thinner. Terrible as I had thought the stamp of evil, which the countenance of Mansur wore when I beheld him in the spirit world, it appeared even more terrible to my thoughts now when I perceived that it had been his influence, which was dragging Jalal ad-Din and myself down and down to the dark kingdoms. I thought of the strange contradictions of the man's character and the curious things he had told me, and I wondered whether they had been true or false. As if in answer to my thoughts, a voice within me replied that all, which he had told me, he had spoken the truth, for while the animal soul of the man had grown so strong with overindulgence that it acted as an almost hopeless clog upon all the efforts of the higher soul to rise into the pure atmosphere of truth, yet the innate love for truth, which dominated him in all those things which pertained to this animal soul, enabled him to recognize a scientific truth when it was presented to his mind, and to sift from it all those husks of error which it had gathered in the earth and lower spheres. Thus on the pathways of knowledge he was truly an efficient guide, while on those of morality his controlling influence led only to destruction. I then asked, where was Mansur? What was the fate of his soul? A dark shadow, black as a cloud of night, appeared on the grey background of the sky, and showed the bent form of a man whose head was bowed unto the earth, while his clasped hands were held aloft in supplication unto heaven. Page by page, picture by picture, did my life's story unroll itself before mine eyes, showing me how mine own actions had influenced the lives around me, and been influenced in turn by them, and how that ceaseless contest between the light and dark angels caused first the one side of man's nature and then the other to be influenced and developed, and how the indulgence of man's passions caused the scales of good or evil to rise or fall. The passionate Artemisia, dominated entirely by her desire for revenge, flitted across the pictures like a restless accursed fury, her absorption in the one idea stunting all the other faculties of her mind, till its balance was destroyed, and that anomaly of thought was produced, which men term insanity. I saw with a keen pang of remorse how my hatred had fed hers, and heaped fresh fuel upon the furnace of her angry passions, till the death of her son at my hands had snapped the last link between her and the power of sober reasoning, and she had in veritable truth not been responsible for her actions when she had shut Zuleika into the secret passage and sat dabbling her hands in my life's blood. I realized through what an awful agony of suffering Artemisia had passed ere she reached that last stage, and I saw how dark and evil had been my own thirst for revenge upon the unhappy mother. When the picture appeared in which I had gathered around the unfortunate Salem the tormenting demons of the dark spheres, I saw a ray of light as from a star dart down to me, and the form of my own mother appear as though she stood afar off and with clasped hands and eyes full of tears, plead to me to think of her, and of what motherhood meant to woman, and bidding me, by the sacredness of my own mother's sufferings, to spare this poor mother whose son was in my power one further pang of suffering at my hands. The full, deep meaning of the picture was clear to my senses now, and I saw not alone one woman pleading unto man for mercy unto woman, one mother speaking in the sacred name of motherhood, but the spirit of the murdered Cynthia pleading for mercy upon her murderess, and atoning for the unconscious wrong which she had done her when she had seemed to rob Artemisia of a heart that never could have been wholly hers. I saw the little seed of compassion and forgiveness sown by my mother's gentle hands, and beheld its first green tender blade shoot into life as I turned away and abandoned my long-nursed desire for vengeance. The pictures then showed me myself wandering in the dark kingdom of the evil angel, that I might learn for myself to what extreme ends the unchecked indulgence in passions such as mine lead men, and what would be the state of society where each one exacted the full measure of his revenge for wrongs suffered at the hands of his neighbor. They showed me Mansur struggling between his awakening desire for good and his enjoyment of things that were evil, drawn to myself by his pleasure in finding a mind that could understand and appreciate the intellectual hunger of his soul, yet unable to resist the temptation to draw me down into the same gulf in which he was. They showed him to me as he watched the stars in the spiritual heavens and noted how the path of my soul's star tended ever in an upward direction till it hung above that of the dark king of evil himself. And to the cunning mind of Mansur came the thought that were he to aid me, I might perchance help to draw him also up with me out of the power of a dark angel, of whose service he had grown weary. Then had come the moment of my danger, and the sudden impulse in Mansur to give me that strange wand, whose virtues were valueless to all in the darkest sphere, since their low state made it impossible for any of the dark dwellers there to retain their hold upon it. I was not so low as those around me, and Mansur believed that it would be possible for me to handle it, and had given it to me while the good impulse was yet strong upon him. His own subsequent fate, terrible as it seemed, was nevertheless the opening of a door through which his soul had found the release it craved, and already his foot was on the lowest step of that long and difficult ladder by which he would yet mount to the higher life of the soul, though even as he himself had said, the distance he would have to climb, and the multitudes he must raise step by step with himself, might well daunt the courage of the stoutest heart. Chapter 15. Artemisia visited again, forgiven. We visit Selim, I visit Zuleika and Bamba. From Mansur my thoughts travelled to my father, and then my pictures showed him to me in the grey robes of a penitent. His kingly dress was gone, his haughty pride humbled, and he seemed slowly and sadly striving to undo the mistakes of his earthly life. Near him I saw the figure of the Puf slave whom he had ordered to be killed. El-Jazid appeared to be stooping over this figure as though to raise him up, and in so doing the vision faded from my sight. Again did the picture of Artemisia rise before my sight, and as I gazed upon it in sorrow and remorse a voice spoke to me, saying, arise and go unto this woman, your one's enemy. Her heart like your head softened, and she will hear you now. Behold, you did rob her of her son, restore him to her sight. You canst do this, for you canst draw him to you on the earth plain, and there you and Artemisia and her son shall meet yet once again. I looked upon the vision of the queen, and I saw that she sat yet by the stormy sea of passion, but its waves rolled unheeded to her feet, the wild wind was hushed, and the dark clouds hung motionless overhead, unnoticed by her, for her head was bowed upon her breast, her face was hidden by her clasped hands, and she was softly, sadly weeping. As I thought, with a newborn feeling of compassion, of her misery, the image of myself was again projected upon the mirror-like atmosphere around her, and my voice seemed to reach her ears, for she started up and gazed with trembling, half-affrighted looks upon my reflection. Oh, Queen Artemisia! Said I slowly, great had been the sin between us both. I, as well as you, have done evil, and I am come to ask your forgiveness for my share, and inasmuch as my hand did rob you of your son, I seek now to restore him unto you. Behold, if you wilt meet me upon the great earth plain, I will draw your son unto you, that you and he may meet once more. Even as I spoke I felt myself rise from the hilltop whereon I stood and float towards the distant globe of the earth, which hovered like a star far away on the horizon. As I lighted upon it, I knew that I was in the palace of Barsaikha'ud and saw that I had entered the haunted rooms. My half-brother Selim was seated upon the same queer-looking attempt at a throne, which I had seen before, and in no respect was his own appearance changed from the strange mixture of age and childishness. I read in his thoughts that he regarded his hurried visit to me in the astral plane, when I had so nearly consigned him to the tender mercies of its horrible inhabitants, as a disagreeable dream, a nightmare vision, nothing more, and that he felt pleased to know that he was still surrounded by scenes with which he was familiar. To his eyes, the palace presented much the same appearance as in his earth life. The change and decay I saw were not visible to him. Artemisia had arrived before me, and now stood before her son, a dark figure with outstretched hands and pleading eyes. The wildness had gone from her expression, though the face was still scarred and wrinkled with the force of the passions that had raged in her heart. Round her figure I saw a faint shimmer of steel-grey light, that enveloped her as with a veil, and changed the intense blackness of despair that had enwrapped her before, into the faint semblance of a garment of hope. She stood beside her son, so close in fact that I thought he must have felt the wild beating of her heart, and yet I saw that she was quite invisible to him. He could no more see the spirit mother who stood beside him than could a mortal have seen himself. He was in his astral body, that first garment of the spirit, which is almost mortal in its materiality, and she was a spirit from the lower sphere, and, as such, 2 degrees further removed from materiality than her son. For whether a spirit ascends or descends as he leaves the encircling belt of the earth plane, he leaves behind him more and more of the earth's materiality, and becomes less and less easily visible to the eyes of mortals or of earth-bound spirits. To become visible, it is necessary that he should clothe himself in the degree of materiality belonging to each sphere, which intervenes between him and the earth. As I saw the look of disappointment and hopelessness that passed over Artemisia's face when she discovered that her son could not see her, could not even feel that she was near him, I understood all at once what my part was to be, and how I could restore her to her son if only for a short time. The magnetic aura, which had enabled the Dark Angel to show himself to Jalal ad-Din during my earth life, was not alone a property of the earthly body. It belonged to the spiritual organism. It was a characteristic of myself. Only the grossest part of that magnetic essence had been cast off with the earth body, and though I could no longer have served as the medium through whom a spirit could manifest his presence to a mortal, my aura enabled spirits of a degree above or below myself to become visible to those who were in an earthbound condition, such as Salims. Moreover, in the atmosphere of the earth plane, the antagonism between my magnetic sphere and that of Artemisia was not so acutely felt as in the more etherealized spheres to which we really belonged, and therefore Artemisia was no longer shut away from me by so impassable a barrier. I could approach her, and as I did so, and the magnetic aura of my spirit enveloped her as a cloud, she became suddenly visible to her son, appearing before him much as an apparition appears to mortals who have imagined there was no one present but themselves. And like a mortal under similar circumstances, Salim was at first startled, almost alarmed, then joy at the sight of the beloved mother overcame all other feelings, and as Artemisia, overcome with a mixture of shame and pleasure, sank at her son's feet, he too knelt down and clasped her in his arms, while I bowed my head and turned away my eyes, that I might not intrude upon the sacredness of their meeting. When Artemisia had returned to the sphere in which she dwelt, I resolved to go and see whether Siuliga was still sleeping where I had left her. When I approached the secret passage, I perceived that she was no longer either asleep or alone. The spirit of the faithful Bamba was sitting where Siuliga had lain, and in the arms of this poor, faithful slave lay Siuliga, as she had lain cradled in them when a helpless infant. Bamba knew all the petty weaknesses, the selfish frivolity, the heartless vanity of Zuleika's nature. She saw with the clear eyes of the spirit all the bitter change that had passed over the once lovely face and form, and she knew it to be but the outward stamp of the degradation of the soul. Yet Zuleika was ever to her the child whom she had nursed, the laughing girl whom she had tended and loved, and the fair woman whom she had served, and for whose life she had laid down her own in the burning desert. Bamba's love had never changed, her faith in Zuleika had never swerved, and she was even dearer to her now in the hour of her misery and degradation than when the one had been almost a queen and the other a poor slave. I read all the nobility of Bamba's thoughts and recognized the purity of her soul, and involuntarily I bowed to the poor slave as I would not have bowed before one of earth's proudest queens. And as I looked up, lo! A golden star shone over Bamba's head, and a thin circlet like a crown of gold hovered for one moment in the air. As for Zuleika, she was weeping like a child in Bamba's arms. But I approached not to her, nor sought to make my presence known, for I saw that she wept, not over the ruin and the sin she had helped to sow around her, but only over the loss of that beauty she had so highly prized. Not yet would I speak to her, for not yet was she able to understand how dead was my love for her, and yet how keen my pity. Chapter 16. Dawn at last. I am visited by our spirit of the golden star. My guide teaches me the folly of aggrandizement, false kings and true kings, false religions and true religions. When I returned to the mountain top which I had left, I saw that the first rays of the rising sun were beginning to light up the dark earth around me, and to touch with a golden glory the tips of the wavelets on the grey sea, while on the spot where I had sat a long ray of golden light rested, like a messenger of hope from the angels of the golden star. As I reached the hill once more, I saw that a majestic spirit in a long robe of grey spangled with little golden stars awaited me, and as he rose from his seat to greet me, I noticed that to his drapery there were attached a pair of golden and grey wings of the most ethereal, transparent beauty, while on his forehead gleamed a golden star. The countenance was majestic and beautiful in the extreme, and the figure tall and commanding. The type of feature was that of an Eastern, the complexion a pale olive, the eyes dark and soft in their velvety darkness, expressing at once power and tenderness. In his hand he held out to me what looked like the very wand, which Mansur had given me in the Dark Angel's kingdom, and, which had vanished mysteriously. "Behold," said he with a grave smile, "I am that spirit of whom Mansur spoke unto you when he gave you this wand. Wonder not that it disappeared when it had served its purpose, for it existed not, save in your own magnetic aura. I projected to you this, its spiritual counterpart, and the materiality of your own spirit clothed it for a time with a form visible to your eyes and to those of Mansur alone. To the dwellers of that sphere, it was invisible because it had not a degree of density akin to their condition, and it vanished from you when the agitation of your mind snapped the slender thread of magnetic communication between us. Yet at the time, it served as a focus upon which I could concentrate my will in support of your. You hast desired to gain the knowledge of spiritual things. Behold, I will give unto you such knowledge. I will teach you the laws by which these spheres exist, and show you what are the means of passing between each, that the spirits who have arisen in the past to answer your desire for knowledge should have come from the dark rather than from the light spheres, is due to the fact that your aspirations after knowledge were inspired by selfish motives, rather than from a wish to use the wisdom gained for the service of your fellow men. Moreover, you hast desired to be a king, as men on earth regard the kingly state, and Io, in yonder dark sphere you hast beheld what the most perfect development of that selfish thirst for aggrandizement doth mean. In the Dark Angel you hast beheld one who was in earth life the greatest emperor the East had known, in those ancient days when a despot was indeed an irresponsible power within his own domains. You hast beheld in him the ultimate development of those baser qualities that make a king great, and a conqueror invincible. No man can desire to aggrandize himself at the expense of his weaker brethren who is not selfish. None can wish to grasp for himself an abnormal share of wealth, while those around him go in rags that he may be clothed in purple and fine linen, who is not greedy. To desire that others shall bow the knee before you and pay you homage, as though you was the divine being personified, shows that pride and vanity alike rule in your heart. To hunger for the territory of other nations that you may swell the extent of your own, to engage in war and bloodshed that you may conquer those who are weaker than thyself, and chain them as slaves to your chariot wheels, is surely to trample upon the just rights of those more feeble than thyself, but who are nevertheless entitled to enjoy such good things as the Lord of all had given to them as well as unto you. And yet, is it not by ignoring the rights of those who have not strength to defend themselves against him, that the earthly conqueror prevails? Is it not by wresting from his fellow that which he is not powerful enough to keep, that the successful warrior swells the number of his own possessions? Doth not ruin and devastation, death and suffering, follow in the track of the mighty conqueror of nations? Is it not true that the greater the conquests are, the more widespread is the misery that follows? Doth not the march of the triumphant army leave in its wake scenes of death and horror more terrible than those of a destroying pestilence? Think of your own earth life, of the hard-wrung tribute ground out of the forced labors of the helpless nations the Persians had enslaved, of the bitter sense of bondage that burns in the breasts of the conquered race, until the smoldering fire breaks forth in what the conquerors term revolt against their usurped power. Think of the stern repression, the cruel measures by which such a revolt is met. Think of the feelings that are born in the breasts of conqueror and conquered alike, and then ask if it is any wonder that hell should be peopled with the great enslavers of their fellow men, or that those who, like the dark angel you hast seen, have devoted all their abilities on earth to the amassing of treasures, the acquisition of territory, the grasping of power, the subjugation of all others' wills to their will, the humbling of all pride but their own, should be kings, not alone on earth, but in those dark spheres where the selfish and brutal qualities of man reign supreme. Ask thyself who have been the greatest kings on earth in the past, and who are likely to be the great emperors of the future, and what are the qualities that most distinguish them above their fellows. Is not the answer ever the same?